First of all, welcome everyone to Middle Earth. I'm really glad that you could make it here. We have a real life Gandalf staff, courtesy of Michael and his family over here, so thank you very much. Yeah, you should give it up. I mean, this is awesome. This is like real movie stuff. I will not be holding it during the talk, so. But yeah, I'm really excited. This is something that I'm super passionate about. I love the Lord of the Rings, always have. It's a part of my childhood and my adulthood, and I think it has a lot to teach us. So we'll just go ahead and kick right off. Tonight marks the beginning of a five-week catechetical series that will explore Middle Earth and the seven sacraments. And each subsequent session will zero in on one or more of the particular sacraments that were instituted by Christ for his church. But in this first session, in this first one, this inaugural Middle Earth entryway, I'd like to just address the elephant in the room that many of you are probably wondering. Why the Lord of the Rings? Why would I choose the Lord of the Rings as a tool for teaching about the sacraments? Is the catechism not good enough? Why should we use the Lord of the Rings? And to be kind of perfectly honest, it's because I love them. I love the Lord of the Rings, and I think I'm not alone. So many of you probably love the Lord of the Rings, and it's a book series that appeals to an incredibly wide range of different kinds of people. I mean, it appeals to like the young and the old. It appeals to Christian and non-Christian. I mean, it's just everyone responds to these stories in a way that I find to be very compelling and very remarkable. There's something about them that stirs the human person deep down, deeper than any dwarf could ever delve. Now, why does the Lord of the Rings impact us in this way? If I may venture a guess, it's simple. When we read the Lord of the Rings or watch the movies, we feel in our heart a deep desire that all of this was real. We feel a desire that this world was real. Something compels us to think there's something piercingly beautiful about this world that we call Middle Earth. Something, or perhaps someone, is speaking to me through these fantastical places, through these bizarre creatures, through these compelling characters, these time-worn landscapes, these epic battles, these unbelievable adventures. And as strange as it might sound, when we read The Lord of the Rings or watch the movies, we start to want, at least somewhere in our heart, we want to believe in them. We want to believe in The Lord of the Rings. It sounds crazy, but I think it's true. To readapt one of my favorite sayings of Bilbo Baggins, it's a dangerous business reading The Lord of the Rings. You crack open a book, and if you don't keep your feet, there's no knowing where you might be swept off to. It is my sincere intention to show in this series on Middle Earth and the Seven Sacraments that Tolkien quite intentionally wanted to sweep us away, and not into some sort of childish daydream, and certainly not into some sort of escapist alternate reality, but rather he wanted to sweep us off into the very heart of truth. He wanted to sweep us off into the heart of reality. In crafting Middle Earth with such meticulous care and attention to detail, I believe that J.R.R. Tolkien wanted to reveal to his readers the way that God and his beautifully painful providence operates in our world, how he operates in his creation that he loves so very much. Maybe some of you can relate when I say that when we read The Lord of the Rings, we kind of recognize Middle Earth. It feels like home in so many different ways. And my prayer for this series is that we trust those instincts, that we can approach these books with wonder and an openness to the truth that they are designed to open up for us. So to reiterate, my proposal to you all and the premise for this entire five-part series is this. What if we wish that The Lord of the Rings was real because it is real? I recently read somewhere that Viggo Mortensen, the guy who played Aragorn in the movie adaptation of The Lord of the Rings, someone asked him, you know, why is The Lord of the Rings so popular? I don't get it. And he replied with, like, the perfect answer. He said, because it's a true story. Tolkien himself seemed to believe this as well. He writes this in one of his letters. He says, probably every writer making a secondary world a fantasy wishes in some measure to be a real maker, or hopes that he is drawing on reality, wishes in some measure to be a real maker, or hopes that he is drawing on reality, hopes that, the peculiar quality of this secondary world are derived from reality or are flowing into it. The peculiar quality of the joy, he says, in successful fantasy can thus be explained as a sudden glimpse of the underlying reality of truth. Peter Kraft, if you've never heard of him, he's great, and he's a big Lord of the Rings fan himself. He's also an apologist for Catholic theology, and he's a great philosopher, teaches up at Boston College. He takes it a bit further. He says, here was a world, and he's talking about Middle-earth, here was a world that was real, in fact, more real, more solid than the one we left when we opened the covers of that book. We were not tourists, but natives. We knew this world. It was our own world, seen more clearly than we had ever seen it before. And now for just a quick disclaimer, though, before we move on. I'm not claiming that Middle-earth exists somewhere in the world, like on an actual map, geographically. And I'm also not claiming in this series that, Tolkien somehow cleverly hid all of the seven sacraments somewhere in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. He wasn't interested in that. And I'm not claiming that there's like a one-to-one correspondence between some of the episodes and the images that we're going to take a look at over the course of this series with the sacraments that were instituted by Christ. It's different, it's more subtle, there's more complexity to it than that. And maybe you've heard some critics say that Tolkien himself like emphatically like disdained and didn't want to do what he called allegory. So he says, I cordially dislike allegory in all of its manifestations. So that might lead you to believe, well, then maybe it's not even appropriate to interpret from the Lord of the Rings like all sorts of Catholic religious themes and symbolism. But that's not true. Like, that's absolutely false. We're very much encouraged to do so, because in, like, another letter, Tolkien also says, the Lord of the Rings is, of course, a fundamentally religious and Catholic work. Unconsciously so at first, he says, but consciously in the revision. He goes on to say that, the religious element is absorbed into the story and all of the symbolism. And if you look at what, you know, Tolkien says about his work and in many of his letters, it's almost like he just let the story unfold. And that was coming out of a deep Catholic faith. I mean, he was very staunchly Catholic, and he loved the Eucharist, he loved the sacraments. And so he didn't set out to like create a story that taught Catholicism necessarily. But because Catholicism was so much a part of him as a person, it couldn't help but come out in his artwork, in his literature. So no, Tolkien didn't disguise the sacraments behind like flat or like overly simplistic allegories. What he did do, however, is craft an amazing world that is surprisingly compatible with reality. Not that like Ents and Hobbits and Orcs actually exist, but in the sense that Middle-earth operates under the same providential logic, the same system of ethics, and the same sacramental potencies as ours does. In short, our instincts are absolutely correct. Middle-earth taps into reality, and it reveals it to us. So how exactly did Tolkien accomplish this? How did he like kind of grasp hold of like the sense of the real and present it to us under these like very, very new ways? The key lies in his understanding of myth, or as he calls it, fairy story. For Tolkien, fairy story was a very particular type of literature, and it was a vehicle precisely for teaching truth, for conveying something about reality, but like in a new and unexpected way. So it presented the truth, but in a way that we would have never expected to see it. He says somewhere, far greater things may color the mind in dealing with the lesser things of a fairy story. So right there, that tells me that he knows that, like, yeah, he's dealing with orcs and elves, and like, you know, you can only take that so seriously. But he's using those elements, those creative things, those artistic motifs to lead us deeper into something that is true for all of us. So basically, Tolkien thought that we tend to grow kind of accustomed to life. You know, we see things happen the way it happens around us every day, and even things that at first we found very spectacular or interesting, you know, the mundanity of it or the repetition of life, the regularity of things can lull us into a sense of, you know, hum, ho-hum, you know? Like, this is just the way things are. And we can forget that God is amazing, that God is really, really present in our midst, that when the priest says, this is my body, this is my blood, that's Jesus Christ saying, I'm here with you, I love you, and I'm willing to die for you, and I rose again for you. So the power of fairy story is that it takes the truths about life that we've started to take for granted and that we've started to kind of get bored with and presents it in a radically new way. It breaks us out of complacency. You know, to hear a story about a little, like, 3-foot nobody walking into the jaws of Mordor is a lot more interesting than, you know, oh, well, I'm going to go to work today. But it's the same thing. You know, like, when you go to work, you know, you might very well be going into Mordor. But that's the point. Fairy story is able to awaken that realization in a way that nothing else quite can. G.K. Chesterton, a great author, in his book Orthodoxy, put it this way. My first and last philosophy, that which I believe in with unbroken certainty, I learned in the nursery. The things I believed most then, the things I believe most now, are the things called fairy tales. They seem to be the entirely reasonable things. They are not fantasies. Compared with them, other things are fantastic. Fairyland is nothing but the sunny country of common sense. So, like, that childlike wonder with the world, that's what fairy story kind of hits at. And it's not naive, because if you've read The Lord of the Rings, it deals with heavy stuff. It deals with very dark themes of despair, themes of just, like, at times what seems to be hopelessness. And yet, it can turn on a dime. And then we can catch that glimpse that Tolkien keeps talking about, that God is present and that God is in charge, that providence is always going to work things out for the best. And, you know, because of all this, because it does this in such a subtle way, I think that's exactly why The Lord of the Rings happens to be such an amazing tool for evangelization. So, you know, if you hear people talk about The Lord of the Rings, it's fairly, you know, innocuous. They don't read it as if it's like a preachy book. You know, they don't think, oh, well, here comes J.R.R. Tolkien, Mr. Catholic, shoving his Catholicism down our throats. No, you'll rarely ever hear anyone say anything like that. In fact, I've found that most often they've completely overlooked or not noticed the Catholic, the very obviously Catholic elements in Lord of the Rings. They're hidden so well, and yet, with the eyes of faith, they just stick out. They stick out like a Silmaril in Morgoth's helmet. So, you know, kudos to you if you got that reference. So here we are. I think that this is a genius move on Tolkien's part, though, because really he's preparing his readers' hearts, whether they realize it or not, to receive the fullness of the gospel. So whether they realize it or not, their hearts are being cultivated. He's planting seeds about virtue, about justice, about loyalty, about friendship, about mercy, freedom, and providence. So he's planting them deep down into the Lord of the Rings fanboy's soul, so that when they finally meet the person of Jesus, so that when they finally hear the gospel and they have ears to hear and eyes to see, they will recognize him. They will recognize him. They can suddenly and unexpectedly say, ah, yes, I recognize Jesus' sacrifice on Mount Calvary because I already walked with Frodo and Sam up Mount Doom to destroy the ring. He can say, you know, I'm open to the resurrection because, you know, I was there when Gandalf the Grey fell into the pit of Moria with the Balrog and then saw him, you know, raised and wearing gloriously white robes, and he comes and saves the day. I can believe in the sacraments now because I tasted Lembas bread, because I heard the crash of waters cleansing Isengard, because I smelled the king's foil fill the room with a scent of healing aroma, because I heard Aragorn's words after a deathbed confession from a friend, "Be at peace, son of Gondor." All of these things, you know, we can take light of them and say, well, that's just a cool story. You know, in this age of CGI and, you know, special effects, you know, a lot of it can get washed over us. But these are real things that the Lord of the Rings hit at in a way that, you know, I've never stumbled across something that quite does it the same way. I know that I've been evangelized by Lord of the Rings. So when I was in middle school, that was when I first read them. And they were really the only things that I would read. And the thing was because they had cool creatures and, like, amazing lands and interesting things. And so Tolkien, like, he snared me with that. He caught me. He hooked me with those things that, like, a middle schooler thinks is cool. And then he dragged me into the depths of, like, what really matters. So, yeah, elves are still cool, but the fact that that elves are longing for, you know, the undying lands, and they're not quite happy until they get there, that's striking at a truth that's way beyond just a middle schooler thinking that elves and orcs are interesting. So at this point, so that's kind of my, you know, fervorino trying to explain that Lord of the Rings is important. But now I'd like to turn kind of towards the fact that, like, Lord of the Rings conveys truth as it's taught by the Catholic faith, especially with regard to sacramentality. So this idea of sacramentality. Sacramentality is a principle in Catholic theology that is broader than the seven sacraments instituted by Christ. So it's kind of like the foundation upon which the idea of a sacrament is even based on. The principle of sacramentality gets at the fact that God is able to disclose himself to us through creation, and that he speaks to us through just ordinary, mundane things. We take this for granted, but it's really amazing that God can speak to us through creation. Sacramentality has to do with the fact that we worship God using things of this world, stuff like bread, wine, water, oil, the spoken word. You know, we think about that as like, oh, well, that's very intellectual. But really, without the vibrations in the air, you know, we wouldn't be able to hear anything. Scriptures written on paper. Again, we think of the written word kind of different than just, you know, stuff, but without the ink on the paper, without the tangibility of the paper, without the screen that we're reading stuff from, we have no way for that to impact us. We have no way for that truth to permeate us and hit our soul. We relate to God through tangible stuff because we are tangible stuff, right? We're made of body and soul. So before we ever get to a particular sacrament, whether it's baptism, Eucharist, or matrimony, or whatever, we first must affirm that deeply Catholic conviction that creation reveals God's presence to us. The cosmos itself is a word from God that conveys his presence. Human beings are not computer chips. They're not Google machines. They're not brains floating around a test tube. We are a composite of body and soul. We engage reality through the senses. And so we are completely dependent on this idea of sacramentality to understand God's self-communication. We need God to speak to us in a language that we can understand and perceive as embodied souls. And he's more than willing to do this because he's a good father and he wants to speak to his children. He created matter. C.S. Lewis says, you know, God likes matter. He created it. So he wants to speak into that. Psalm 19 expresses this probably most beautifully when it says, "The heavens are telling the glory of God, and the firmament proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours forth speech, and night to night declares knowledge. There is no speech, nor are there words. Their voice is not heard, yet their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." This is amazing stuff that God is shouting at us from the created order, the beauty around us, the wind and the trees and the rivers and the mountains. Those are all things that play a central part in Lord of the Rings. Those are all elements of Middle-earth that make it so real and tangible to us. And here it is, the psalm saying that these very things are the things that shout at us, stars, you know, that, you know, God breathed out stars, and stars take a very important role within the Middle Earth mythology. You know, and so all of these realities, you know, converge to say the cosmos is telling us something. The fact that we exist and say that, like, we can look at a beautiful bird or, like, an animal anywhere, these realities we shouldn't take for granted. They are shouting at us that God loves us. So understood from this perspective, sacramentality is tangibly present as one reads through The Lord of the Rings. And that's because Tolkien took a lot of time and energy to craft a believable world. The rolling hills of the Shire, they burst with innocence and carefree joy, right? They just kind of, you want to go hang out in the Shire and have some beer at the Green Dragon. You just do. It sounds like an awesome place. The Misty Mountains, they feel daunting and impassable. They feel like they're just standing in your way, you know, blocking your adventure. The Mines of Moria, they go on forever and ever and ever, and they just feel so bleak and dark. The Towers of Minas Tirith, they gleam in the light, and you can almost hear those silver trumpets blasting. So sacramentality, it's embedded within the logic of the entire Lord of the Rings cosmos. Middle Earth has meat on its bones, and thus it can communicate something of God's presence in creation to us as the reader. I know oftentimes when you talk about reading The Lord of the Rings, people kind of, they're like, yeah, I tried reading The Lord of the Rings, but then, you know, I read that description of the old forest, and it was just, ugh. So, like, we kind of notice that he goes into this, like, painstaking detail about the landscape and, like, the roads and the maps and even the songs that they happen to be singing and all of this stuff and, like, what they were eating for breakfast. But all of these things are part of our life, and they kind of show us that there's something real here, that this is an inhabitable place. Every single element of Middle Earth bears meaning and points beyond itself. But then this kind of brings us to kind of the fact that God speaks to us through creation par excellence. And I'm speaking, of course, of the incarnation of his only begotten Son. That is like the defining moment when God, who is spirit, presents himself and becomes flesh, right? The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. This is the ultimate instance, the full revelation of God, of God speaking through creation, that God would become fully man and be united with humanity in that way. This is the moment that the architect enters into the blueprint. Like, we can't even fathom that. This is the moment that the painter enters into his painting. Like, that's mind-blowing. This is the moment that the Son of God was sent into the world not to condemn it, but to save it. The church sings in one of its great Marian hymns, "To the wonderment of nature you bore your Creator, yet remained a virgin after as before." That's speaking to the fact that Mary, though she was just a creature, was able to contain the Creator. This is the central mystery of our faith, and it's what distinguishes Christians from any other religion, that God would step into history in such a powerful way. And it's exactly there that we find the heart of sacramentality, because the sacraments are only efficacious because of the fact of the incarnation of Christ. Insofar as Christ took up our humanity and took up all of creation by extension, does the sacraments have any power? So Jesus' entire life, you know, Jesus' entire life, culminating, of course, in the Paschal mystery, shows us the Father's heart. Jesus' entire life shows us the Father's heart. Everything he said or did, his gestures, his actions, his words, the things that he allowed to happen to him, the healings that he performed, the signs that he gave, all of it, they're all redemptive and they're all revelatory. Jesus says of himself, "Truly, truly, I say to you, the Son can do nothing of his own accord, but only what he sees the Father doing. For whatever he does, that the Son does likewise." Jesus is the word of love spoken to us definitively. And he has given us the gift of his sacraments to extend that incarnation through space and time, right? It's the way that the Paschal Mystery gets applied to our lives here and now. The church is the sacrament of God's love. It's the way that we can enter into the same mystery, into the same events of Jesus' life that continues, that he is alive and continues to intercede for us at the right hand of the Father. The sacraments are proof of that, that he has ascended and is now present in his mysteries. The Catechism says that what was visible in our Savior has passed over into his mysteries, or in other words, into the sacraments of the church. So that's kind of where that is. But yeah, in light of all this discussion of the incarnation, though, I thought maybe that it would be kind of cool to close our initial session tonight with kind of a brief imaginative reflection about the Ring of Power. So I haven't really thought this all the way through, but I think that it's something to kind of chew on and think about. So I'm going to just pitch it at you and see what you say. I think that the one ring of power is kind of an anti-sacrament or maybe an anti-sacramental. I think that it can be interpreted as like a mockery and a distortion of sacramentality. And so let me try to explain what I mean. I hope this isn't heresy. We just covered that the principle of sacramentality is that conviction that God communicates himself through created realities. So God freely chooses to speak his word of life through tangible stuff that we can perceive and enter into. So sacramentality finds its perfection and its fulfillment in the incarnation of Christ. So like Jesus is fully God, fully man, walking among us. And in the sacraments, God gives us his own life. So the ring, it operates in kind of a deceptively similar fashion, though it's altogether evil. So as you may know, the one ring was forged in secret by the Dark Lord Sauron, and it was created, it was an act of treachery. So like the elves were creating these rings of power, and they were making rings for the dwarf lords and the men and like all these different people. And so Sauron was acting like a good guy. He was pretending that he was on their side and that he was going to help them and they were going to bring about, you know, whatever, some sort of good order in the world. And you should just never trust Sauron. You should just never trust him, no matter how pretty he looks, no matter how... But that was just it. He looked beautiful. He presented himself as an angel of light, maybe. And he deceived the world. He deceived the elves that didn't know until the last moment that he had created a secret master ring that would rule all the other rings. So he went off to his like little, you know, dungeon like lair thing in Mordor, where there's this giant volcano, and he made this ring. And into this ring, if you've watched the movies, into this ring he poured all his cruelty and all his malice. But he also poured something else into it. He poured a little bit of himself into it. He poured quite a bit of his power, actually, into it. And that's why I think, that, like, right there, that fact that he put himself into this physical object and gave his presence into this thing, into this, like, little condensed object, that's where I think it's a mockery of sacrament. Because, like, God, if you think about it, God wants to spend himself and give himself totally away in the sacraments. When we go to the sacraments, we're not just receiving abstract ideas about, oh, isn't this pretty? Isn't it nice to, like, you know, go up to the communion with everybody that's my friends? Like, we're receiving the living God. We're receiving the living God, and Jesus is giving himself away completely gratuitously. But that's, like, inverted with the ring. That's inverted. So Sauron, the reason that he pours himself out is not to give himself away for the building up of the church. Like, the sacraments are all, like, they're given to us specifically to build up the church and bring us into union with God. Sauron pours himself into the ring of power out of fear, out of pride and fear. Pride because he thinks that he's big and strong enough to protect that ring and keep it forever. He puts all of his energy into this one little object so that he thinks that he has enough power in himself to hold on to it and keep it. And fear, it's the other side of the coin. Fear because he is afraid that if he doesn't condense this power, if he doesn't hedge his bets, if he doesn't consolidate all of his might, then somebody else is going to take it away from him. And we see the effects with this ring all through the story of Lord of the Rings, is that whenever somebody has it, when they are a ring bearer, they start to act crazy. They start to think that they have the power. They start becoming afraid and hysterical and paranoid that somebody else is going to take it from them. And so they start to act like Sauron. They start to become him, which is another mockery of the sacraments. When we receive the sacraments, we're receiving the life of God. We become more like Christ, or at least that's what it's supposed to be. We're supposed to be opened up to the fact that we're becoming more like Jesus. The ring, when we give ourselves to the ring, when we say, this is what I want, I don't want the Shire, I don't want Gandalf and his wisdom, I don't want Aragorn and his wisdom either. I want this little tiny ring that makes me feel invincible. You can see why that would go to someone's head. You can see why you'd start to be afraid and anxious and burdened. And really, that's what we are under the effects of sin, when we choose something less than God, when we want to put all of our bets on something that is, in the end, very small and very pitiful, and yet something that's so hard to get rid of. Like, when we invite sin into our hearts, it's really hard to get rid of it. We have to go to the fires of Mount Doom. We have to go to the cross. And that's not fun. It's very costly. That's kind of where I was at with the ring. I don't know. it's so amazing. I just love The Lord of the Rings. I think that it's a very fascinating story. I think it speaks into our everyday life. Over the next 4 weeks, we're going to be discussing all of the seven sacraments, all of those authentic and life-giving sacraments that Jesus instituted for us. He gave us these gifts to not to enslave us like the ring does. He doesn't want to control us. He doesn't want to dominate us. That's the other thing about the ring. It's all about domination, pushing other people down to raise me up. That's not what the sacraments are about. The sacraments are all about giving away, all about receiving the fullness, and about receiving complete freedom. Freedom. For freedom, Christ set us free. That's what Paul wrote to the Galatians. So don't submit yourselves again to the yoke of slavery. That's what he says. Don't submit to the yoke of slavery. Don't submit to that ring of power. It's so puny in the long run, and it turns you into something that you're not. You are not created to be Sauron. You're created to be, Frodo, I guess, or maybe even Sam. So we're going to be talking about those characters and kind of thinking about, you know, what they represent or what they can teach us. Don't submit again to the yoke of slavery. That's a really important thing to kind of remember as we continue on in this series and talk about the sacraments. I'm really excited for it. I'm glad that you guys came to this first session. Our adventure into Middle Earth will take us through first the sacraments of initiation. So next week we'll be talking about baptism, Eucharist, and confirmation. And then after that, I think, is the sacraments of healing. So anointing of the sick and reconciliation. And then the fourth one is, I believe, matrimony or holy orders. I don't know. Those might be mixed up at the end. But long story short, we're going to kind of take it like one step at a time try to see how far we can flesh this out and enter into these mysteries together. So, yeah, once again, thank you again for coming out. And I'll open the floor for questions if you have any. Thank you.